The following podcast contains explicit language and content that may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Hello.
Hi.
And welcome to the Guest Bookie Podcast, where two married guys share stories of paranormal encounters, urban legends, true crime, and other scary things from around the world. I'm Andres.
And I'm Kevin.
And what's going on?
It's July.
Yes, it is July.
I don't know what I'm doing. Have you guys all listened to our Cheekysode that we released a few weeks ago?
Yeah, it was at the beginning of the month.
Yeah. It was supposed to be in June, but we got busy with stuff.
We delayed it.
Yeah.
And then now this episode's later, a little later than usual.
Yes, usually the episode is out by now, but we have been kind of busy with a lot of like personal stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, just personal stuff that's been going on. I took a break from social media. I know that a couple people have messaged and they've been asking how I've been doing. So I just want to thank everybody that was kind of concerned. I'm okay, just going through some mental health stuff, but getting things taken care of, and it's okay to talk about, and it's okay to acknowledge that we're having a hard time. So just wanted to put that out there in case anybody was going through a hard time again, like I am right now. It has been really hot here. It's been over 100 degrees where we live. And so it's just been very hard on the days that it's nice trying to fit everything in that you haven't been doing during the rest of the week because it's too hot to leave the house.
Yes, it's completely unbearable. I mean, I don't know. I can't stand people that are like, I love summer. It's like, are you sure? Are you sure?
They're usually not from here.
That's true.
They're usually like...
When they refer to summer as like Florida summer. Florida. They're like somewhere on the coast summer. California summer.
Florida summer is not that great either. It's super humid.
That's disgusting.
But California summer, that's great. That's a good time.
Yeah.
That's a good time. If you live near the ocean, not if you live out towards the desert like Temecula and stuff like that.
Huh, okay.
Yeah, it's a desert. Anyways, but, so anything else going on? Anything we need to catch our primos and primas about?
Sorry, I kind of touched on it, but the new episode, our Cheekysode came out. To those that don't know that just listen to like our regular episodes, Cheekysodes are listener stories. I don't know if maybe someone reads it and they're like, I don't know what that says or I don't know what that's about. So they just kind of skip it because we have noticed a trend of those not getting as much attention as our regular episodes, which is fine. I mean, I understand people have their preferences. It's like they'd rather listen to us talk about the cases we research than listener stories. But just wanted to give that a little attention. And you guys are always welcome to send us your own personal stories if you guys want to be featured on those.
Absolutely.
Or if you guys just don't want to share, you guys are welcome to share and say, hey, I want to share this with you. Please don't include it in the episode. That's totally fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
We do ask that you mention that. We like your name, if you want us to include it, whether you want it to be on the episode or you're just sharing, because that, I mean, that happens. And your pronouns, preferably. That way we refer to you
using the correct pronouns.
With the correct pronouns.
Absolutely. We always want to be respectful. Did we go to the Twice concert before or after we filmed the last episode?
I don't remember.
Or I said filmed. Filmed. As if we're back here on camera. No, we're just recording.
I think we recorded it before.
Oh, okay, so we went to go see Twice in Dallas, in Arlington specifically. Those women perform. It was a great performance. I have been wanting to... I wish I could see that performance again.
I still talk about it. It's been an entire month.
We literally still talk about it.
So those that don't know, Twice is a K-pop group.
Yes, we're K-pop stans.
Stream Super Shy by New Jeans.
Yeah. That just came out. So...
The new Barbie movie came out and we watched it.
We did watch the Barbie movie.
We're not going to talk about spoilers, but I really liked it.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't sound exciting. I'm sorry.
We were not the target audience, and you know that we were not the target audience, but I do have an appreciation for that movie because of what it does.
Yes. Not all movies are for men, and we acknowledge that.
Yeah, exactly. I would go watch it again if I could. It was a very fun time to watch that movie.
I think it'll resonate more with women, definitely.
It will. Yes, that's the intended target audience. The girls that like grew up playing with Barbies or Bratz or just dolls in general. And just kind of like what women go through on a daily basis in like society.
Existing as a woman, it touches on sisterhood, motherhood,
relationships between women.
Yes. Well,
sisterhood, I guess, kind of like covered that. Mm-hmm. But specifically the relationship between a mom and a daughter and kind of like those difficult years that happen sometimes.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of touched on that. It touched on themes of like, maybe like the symbolism of kind of like what Barbie was intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of got taken into a different direction. And so it was just kind of...
I think the movie makers are self-aware of how Barbie was portrayed and how it evolved over time.
Yes.
So I like the self-awareness aspect of it.
Yeah.
I like how they break the fourth wall constantly. But yeah, we don't want to spoil anything. We just want to recommend it in case you all haven't seen it. So do you want to jump into the case?
Yeah, we can. It's your turn first this time, actually, because I did the mirror first in the episode last time.
Okay. So it's the month of July, and when I think of the month of July, I think of France.
Why? Why July?
Because of the 14th of July.
Please, I'm ignorant.
Le 14 juillet.
I don't know what that is. Please explain.
So
I'm sure nobody else is going to know either.
Okay, like, so...
waiting for me to say, oh, yeah, yes. Like, oh! Exactly. No, please explain.
So the 14th of July in France is celebrated. It's formally known as, like, Le 14 juillet, but a lot of people also know it as Bastille Day.
I know that band.
I'm going to kill you. So, Bastille Day, La Bastille, the Bastille is a old prison in France that was raided, or like they were stormed the Bastille during the French Revolution. And I guess it kickstarted a lot of things after that, but it's considered like kind of a national holiday.
What did it kickstart?
The French Revolution.
Okay, perfect.
Because they were protesting.
Mm-hmm.
France loves a good protest.
Yeah. Was this before or after Miss Loves Cake?
I think that was before.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think that's kind of what started the chain events
of... Marie Antoinette, Miss Loves Cake.
Bring out the guillotine, mama. Yeah,
to be specific.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if people will get the reference if I just say Miss Loves to Eat Cake.
Yeah. I understood. So, I am covering Les Catacombes de Paris.
Oh.
I'm so sorry. Je suis désolé si je prononce mal quelque chose.
He's flexing on us because he can speak French.
I'm so sorry if I mispronounce something. So, here are my sources. The Catacombs, Catacombes de Paris website, Heritage Daily article by Marcus Milligan, The Tour Guy article by Sean Finelli. Reddit, specifically the subreddit Unsolved Mysteries. A YouTube video by History Channel. A YouTube video by Geographics. A YouTube video by Just Creepy. And Wikipedia.
This is starting to get interesting. Oh, there's a lot of sources.
I guess also a YouTube video by Amy's Crypt. I suggest her. I really recommend her YouTube channel. So the city of Paris is divided into 20 districts called arrondissements, arranged in a clockwise spiral starting from the inside out. But today I'll be talking about a location that's entrance can be found in the 14th arrondissement to the south of the city, but can technically be found all over, I guess. Sorry, I shouldn't have given away the case that I'm covering. I should have started just reading, right? I put on my little introduction paragraph. So within the 14th arrondissement, you can find the entrance to one of Paris's strangest attractions, the Paris Catacombs. They're considered underground ossuaries. I don't know if I pronounced that right. It's an English word, but an ossuary is basically like a collection of bones. Os is Latin for bone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, which is a place for final resting place of human remains. It's located in a building that makes up half of La Barrière d'Enfer, meaning the Gate of Hell. La Barrière d'Enfer used to be a toll house several centuries ago, but now consists of an eastern and western building. The western building houses the highway service, while the eastern building houses the Inspector General of Quarries, where the entrance to the catacombs lie. Side note, which I think I'll start doing for any future location that we cover. I checked the map to see the location of the entrance, and there was small cafes around the area, tea shops, bookshops, doctor's offices. But one that stood out to me the most was a restaurant called Asian Food.
Just straight up Asian food?
It was titled Asian Food. The thing is, it sells pho and Chinese fusion dishes. But when I was looking at their menu, I was like, what the fuck? And to those who don't know, France colonized Vietnam. So I'm like, why you gotta be disrespectful like that? To me, I was like, that's a little weird. And the thing is, it was in English. It was just titled Asian Food, but it's primarily sold, pho.
As long as, oof.
There's just something weird about it. I know that different cultures take things a little differently, but to me, I was like, this is weird.
You know, I don't mean to talk shit, but...
But we do anyway.
Yeah, and I was on, this just reminds me of fucking Brit talk all over again when they were eating fucking Asian food, and their idea was chips with fucking gravy and peas on it.
Oh yes,
that is so, what the and fuck
chips
is
you mean
that?
Chips by french fries.
I was like, what the fuck? I'm excuse me, where's the sesame chicken? Where's the orange chicken? Where's the beef and broccoli? Where's the fried rice?
That is a little weird.
They don't eat that?
I forgot about that. That was a trend on Twitter, right?
Yeah, no, TikTok.
Oh, TikTok.
Brit talk. I said Brit talk.
Oh, Brit talk. I thought talk TALK.
No. TOK. Talk. Yeah.
Talk.
TikTok.
TikTok, 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 TikTok.
Stop.
So, as for the origin of these catacombs, the quarries and tunnels were carved by the Romans in the 2nd century after they conquered what is now France, formerly known as Gaul. The area surrounding Paris was rich in limestone, which is the Romans' favorite building material to build the city above, or they used it to build the city above. So nearly 2,000 years of digging and mining, it created over 180 miles, which is around 290 kilometers of tunnels. The rise of Christianity in medieval Paris ended the pagan practice of cremation of the dead, where instead people preferred to bury their loved ones in cemeteries. So, after about 10 centuries of burials around the late 18th century, cemeteries began to fill up. Because
I don't even want to know.
Wait, it gets worse.
Oh no!
I think that's a good subtitle of. Wait, it gets worse. Because Paris was a walled city at the time, the city was unable to expand further to accommodate the growing and dying population. Corpses were buried and left in the ground for a few years to decompose. When a cemetery would get full, the bodies were unburied and stored in charnel houses on the outside of cemeteries, which, from my understanding, it was like these little stone houses just full of bones. So they would wait for the bodies to decompose enough and then just kind of throw the bones into this little stone house.
Wait, is it like a Barbie house? Like a small house? Or like...
No, it was kind of...
Like
it was
a cottage?
When I mean small, it's like... I don't know, like...
He's raising his arms above his head and doing a circle movement, so... Because...
No, I mean, I was... It was like... I don't know, just a room. It's just a room. It's not even a house. It's just a room.
Does it have a roof?
Yes.
Okay.
So the ground was then reused for new burials again. So it's like they buried people, waited a while, and then unburied them and put them in these houses.
They forgot to pay their rent, so they got moved out.
Oh, girl. That reminds me of something. That's a case for a future episode. These overflowing cemeteries became a public health hazard. Le Cimetière des Saints Innocents, or Le Cimetière des Innocents, considered the largest cemetery in Paris at the time, was so overfull with corpses that some even spilled over into the basements of nearby apartment buildings. After so many petitions to get it closed, it finally closed in 1780, because people were just fucking tired of it. Like, if you can imagine living in an apartment building and then, like, the basement wall just fucking caves in and in comes bones. Dead bodies. Yeah.
Wait, not even, yes, dead bodies, not even dead bones. Dead bodies. Yeah. No, mm-mm.
Because once they become bones, they get taken out of the ground.
Well, you know what? Maybe if rent was cheap enough.
I'm going to gloss over that. So at the time, Parisians were questioning where to put the corpses. The quarries under the city were being fixed up and reinforced because some quarry voids were collapsing, affecting the city above. So after centuries of these tunnels under the city, some of them began to, like, cave in. The Tombe Issoire quarries were a convenient choice because at the time, with much of them being located outside of the city in the plains of Mont Rouge, they thought, oh, well, perfect. It's not really going to affect us, I guess. In 1786, excavations? Did I misspell something? Evacuations is better. Evacuations from Le Cimetière des Innocents started, and the bones were collected at night, dumped into quarry wells, and then piled into the galleries by quarry workers. There were no tombstones because many of the bodies had been just piled into mass graves from the overcrowding. There was no organization to the bones in the quarries at the time. It wasn't until 1810, they dumped all these bones down these wells and people waiting at the bottom would just kind of collect them and just kind of push them all into one room. They were big enough to be like galleries.
That's scary.
Yeah. So it wasn't until 1810 when the galleries were transformed into mausoleums and the bones were used to reinforce the walls or to hold back a collection of disorganized bone piles. So I'm sure everyone has seen pictures. If not, we can post them. Well, we'll post them on the Instagram and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
But now the way that they are now is that they're organized based on like bone type. So it's like these large arrangements of walls, but they were put there because behind them it's just like unorganized piles of bones.
Did nobody stop and think, maybe this is a little disrespectful to these people that have passed away or like the family members that are still alive?
See, that's what I was thinking too. But to me, I was thinking if it was centuries of people, they probably didn't have any living relatives. Or if they did, I don't think it was really like up to their choice where it's like, would they ask the families like, hey, is it okay if we move your relatives? Like, I agree with you, but it's like the other option, which is to let these cemeteries keep getting overfilled.
That is just strange to me because, like, did the church not get involved? They're always up in everybody's business. They're always up in everybody's business. So I'm surprised. The only reason I ask is because we had a family member that passed away a long time ago that was cremated.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we asked the priest to come bless the area where the urn was going to be, he said, the Catholic Church doesn't believe in that. So no, I will not be going to your home to bless the area.
Yeah.
So I'm like, they're real particular about respecting people's bodies. Oh, okay. So like, what the fuck was going on here? And they're always up in everybody's business. So I know they had something to do here.
Sorry, I didn't mean to smack my lips. I'm so sorry. But yes, I know what you mean, because I believe with a lot of Christian denominations, they believe that you should be buried because when the second coming comes, when the second coming happens.
Yes, I like that one better. The other one was weird.
when the second coming happens, your soul will be returned to your body and then you will bring everlasting life.
Zombie apocalypse.
Close. So close. Eternal life, actually, in heaven.
A turtle life?
Eternal.
Eternal, okay.
Eternal.
I'm okay with turtles, too. They're kind of cute. I went jogging the other day, and I saw one, and contrary to popular belief, I did not pick it up and put it in the water, because this was a tortoise and doesn't know how to swim.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can tell based on their feet. If they have little webbed feet, they probably go in the water. If they do not have little webbed feet, they do not go in the water. But then again, you should probably not touch any animals.
No.
Anyway, back to the point. Yes, a lot of Christian denominations don't believe in cremation for that reason. So, to be honest, I don't know. I didn't see anything in my research that would have alluded to the church being involved in, like, being against it. But I don't see why they would, because it wasn't like they were going against a burial. It was just moving them from one burial to another.
Okay.
Which is, I think, is how they justified it to a lot of people at the time. Where it's like, we're just kind of moving them.
Mm-hmm.
So in total, an estimated 5 to 6 million skeletons were moved into what is now the catacombs. The human skeleton is made up of 206 bones, so for 6 million skeletons, there's an estimated 1.236 billion bones below Paris. Of the over 180 miles, which is, again, 290 kilometers that make up the catacomb tunnels, less than a half mile, which is about 0.8 kilometers, is open to the public. There are over 800 meters of corridors lined with bones and skulls, some in very ornate and organized systems. I don't know if you've seen where some have, like, some skulls are shaped in, like crosses, some are just, like, in patterns. There's one that's built as, like, a throne, kind of, made of skulls, which to me was, like,
a little weird.
This is weird. These constructed walls of bones have to be shifted and rearranged often to compensate for the shifting walls. Sorry, that didn't make any sense.
No, the earth moves.
Yes, that.
Yeah,
the earth moves, so you constantly have to, they have to be reformatting them so it doesn't, like, collapse on itself. The remainder of the tunnels are considered dangerous, unstable, and unexplored. During World War II, sections of the catacombs were occupied by Nazis and other sections were occupied by the French Resistance. In 1955, it became illegal to enter the catacombs without authorization. Manholes in Paris were welded shut to prevent accidents and people getting lost. There have even been specific sewer entrance plates installed that are designed to cut off your fingers if you try to lift them to enter unauthorized sections of the tunnels. So, it's extreme. However, there were still many other entrances unknown to the general public. There were entrances in schools, businesses, apartment buildings. There are stories from people who accidentally wandered into the catacombs from cellars or basements only to have to retrace their steps to get back out. In 2017, a group of criminals used the catacombs to access an apartment.
Wait, you just glossed over that. Hold on.
What?
Back up. So you mean to tell me that there's just like open rooms and like miles of bones on walls and people's cellars and in the cellars of businesses and apartment buildings, and people have gotten lost in there?
Yes and no. So the tunnels, they expand huge amounts of Paris, but they're only like a very small selection that have the bones. The other ones are just tunnels. Sorry, maybe I didn't specify, but there was only a very small section where the bones were collected.
Okay. But I'm sorry, I'm not understanding. So, like, I could walk down into my basement and then walk and say, wow, this basement is really big, and then be like half a mile away from my house in like a tunnel.
Yes, it happens sometimes where there are some stories that I found that I didn't really include because they were so tiny, but it's like some people say, hey, I work in a restaurant and our cellar's what is it called, like wall broke and you can see into like the tunnels, because these are huge and old cities, so some buildings were just, they just kind of built over them.
Oh damn. Well, it makes sense.
Yeah. And I'll give one another example soon, but oh well, this one, I guess. In 2017, a group of criminals used the catacombs to access an apartment's underground vault. They drilled through the limestone to enter the vault and stole a collection of vintage wine valued over 250,000 euros, which is around $322,250. Above the entrance of the catacombs is an engraving of Arrête, c'est ici l'Empire de la Mort, which means stop, here is the Empire of Death. On the reverse side of the entrance, the engraving reads, Quocumque indec... Sorry, this is not... this is Latin. So, Quocumque ingrederis sequitur mors corporis umbra. It means, wherever you go, death follows, moving like a shadow. There's a wall on the catacombs covered in scratches that no one knows where they came from, whether they were there before or after the bones were moved is unknown.
So we got an as above, so below situation going on here with that sign.
You've seen that movie?
We've seen that movie together multiple times.
I fell asleep.
I love that movie.
Okay. So you know that movie was actually filmed in these catacombs and these tunnels, right?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
Okay. So you have a good reference. So yes, I forgot to mention that. Because, again, I fell asleep both times we watched
that movie. That movie was good. I don't know why you fell asleep.
I don't know. I was eepy and sleepy. So, the movie As Above, So Below is based on a group of explorers that go into the Paris catacombs and go into one of these unauthorized sections. Because it is a tourist destination where you are only allowed to go into a select part. The other parts, like I said, are just dangerous because they're unexplored, uncharted. Urban explorers visit the tunnels often, calling themselves cataphiles, who are supposedly more versed in exploring the catacombs. However, even those well-versed or well-traveled risk entering the winding tunnels. There is no light down there, so losing your flashlight could be a matter of life and death. In 1793, a man named Philibert Asper, who worked in the Val-de-Grâce hospital during the French Revolution, was tasked to fetch something in the cellar, but accidentally entered the catacombs instead.
Here it is.
Accidentally. 11 years later, his corpse was found feet away from an exit that was invisible to him in the dark. He was only identified from the hospital keys he had on him at the time of his death. He was buried in the catacombs where his body was found, and it's believed that his soul never left. Cataphiles claim that every 3rd of November, the anniversary of Philibert's death, his spirit can be sighted and heard near where his body was found. In the early 1990s, a group of cataphiles found a video camera with 40 minutes of footage on it. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I remember back in like the early 2000s, they had an episode about this on like World's Scariest Places or like some type of stuff on like ABC Family.
Yes.
Back when they used
Well, hold on. Sorry.
Okay.
You're getting ahead of me. So, the footage found in black and white starts uneventful with a man who never shows his face exploring the catacombs. He picks up bones along the way. As the video progresses, the man becomes nervous, walking with a faster pace. The video gets a bit disturbing when the man encounters a white painting of a humanoid figure with its limbs spread apart. Eventually, he's seen running through the catacombs in a panic, dropping the camera before running into the darkness. The man isn't seen coming back for the camera, and it eventually dies when the battery runs out. A documentarian named Francis Friedland acquired the video and presented it on the ABC Family show Scariest Places on Earth in 2000.
I remember that fucking show. Yes, I could hear it through my microphone.
Should I re-record that sentence?
No. Leave it in. So people can be like, are you guys putting subliminal messages?
I'm just a little hungies. So the episode aired a year after the release of the found footage style cult classic film The Blair Witch Project, leading some to believe that the video was a hoax. However, no one has ever come forward with information about the video, and it is presumed that the man in the video is still missing to this day. If the man died in the tunnels, his body has never been found.
That episode of World's Scariest Places on Earth creeped me the fuck out.
Yeah. In 2004, a group of police officers uncovered 3,000 square feet of galleries wired with phones, a PA system playing dogs barking. It had a bar, a living area, a workshop, a lounge, and a cinema meant to seat 20 people. And most disturbing, cameras on the ceilings recording them. Police showed back up a few days later with a larger team to investigate, but everything they uncovered had vanished. The only thing remaining was a note that read, "Ne cherchez pas," meaning kind of like,
don't look for us.
Yeah, like, don't look for us. If you can imagine the number of bodies that were unburied, there is some for sure leftover negative energy from disrespecting the deceased like that. Of those that have visited the catacombs and the tunnels, many claim that they feel uneasy while they're underground. A famous legend about the catacombs is that you should never be in there after midnight because it is believed that disembodied voices can be heard, persuading visitors to venture deeper and deeper into the tunnels.
I believe it.
Legend claims that an actual gate to hell is hidden somewhere within the catacombs, allowing evil spirits to enter our world. If that doesn't scare you, it's also believed that countless satanic rituals have been performed in the catacombs. So if there wasn't an entrance to hell before, someone probably has opened one already.
Well, if there's entrances to the catacombs for people's cellars and hospitals and buildings and stuff, yeah. There's a little passageway to hell somewhere. The catacombs lead everywhere.
Yeah. To this day, it is not recommended at all to travel beyond the designated path into the uncharted tunnels because you might not come back out. So, they take it very seriously. There are actually police, or like a section of the police in Paris that's designated with making sure that there's no one in these for like prohibited parts of the tunnels.
Right.
Because it is dangerous. I recommend the YouTuber that I mentioned earlier, Amy's Crypt. She's a YouTuber that goes to these haunted locations and kind of gives like quick backstory about it. But there's one episode where she did where she actually visits a forbidden part of the tunnels. It's like an hour long video, but in it you can see how just completely dangerous it is in there. And even like the people that were setting up the bones, like aligning them up to the wall, it was really dangerous because there was a lot of cave-ins. There mm-hmm. were like countless people that lost their lives just trying to build those. I also do recommend the it's a History Channel show called like Underground Worlds or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually did covered an episode on this. But yeah, it is not recommended to go into these sections because, like I said, some people are aware of it. Like, they know not to go into the tunnels. But, I mean, people still risk it.
I mean, there was the one story of, and I don't know if you've included it on your research, but that young girl that went to a rave, and then she was lost. Her phone ran out of battery or something like that. She was using her flashlight. Uh-huh. It ran out of battery. They were looking for her for 6 months before somebody ventured in a cave and found her. Like maybe 20 minutes away from like where the rave originally was. Like she got lost in the catacombs and then died of starvation.
No, I never heard of that.
Yes. That one happened recently, actually.
See, I mean, it happens. It's dangerous. A lot of firefighters actually do like rescue drills in the catacombs too. So I did have one last story. So next is an encounter that someone experienced in the catacombs that I found on YouTube. It is a little fantastical, I will admit, but it was one of the only like cases I found of like a personal encounter of mm-hmm.
I found the story. It was from an article by Vice, and her name was Masha. She went to, she got lost in the catacombs. So that's pretty interesting. It came out in 2015. The article did.
Yeah. Oh, also another thing that kind of reminds me, there are entrances, like I said, to like a lot of schools. So what a lot of high school kids did, like especially during like the 80s and 90s, is that before or after class, probably after class would make more sense, they would like go into the cellar of their schools, go into like the tunnels through there,
mm-hmm.
and they would just like spray paint, they would drink, they would have like a little rave type of thing. So it was not uncommon
for that. So let me read you this little blurb. She was drunk and got lost in the catacombs. She became separated from the group she was with and spent 3 days wandering in the freezing cold and pitch black before she died of dehydration. It took 2 years before the police were able to locate her body and retrieve it from the catacombs. And so 2 years. So I was wrong. And this article that I'm looking at is from Atlas Obscura, and it came out around the same time the Vice article did in 2015. So it happened a while back, but it still happens.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's really dangerous out there. And that's scary to think that it would take years to find your body.
Well, I mean, there's miles of caves.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I'm referring to. I don't think people realize like how expansive it is. And Paris is a huge city. Most of the catacombs take up the entirety of the city, if not more, like outside of it too.
I don't know. I'm trying to imagine like what I would think if I was just stuck out there in the catacombs without like any light. And I don't think my heart could handle it, because I would think somebody would grab me from behind in the dark at any minute.
Yep. Oh, to be in pitch black? Like, no, that's scary.
Where you're hearing whispering, and then obviously, like, there's noises from above in the street, so, like, you're going to feel the rumbling of cars and things, so.
Metro train.
Yep.
That's what I was. In the video by Amy's Crypt, there is a section where they're, like, walking in the tunnels, and you can, she's like, oh, that's the metro train, like, right next to us.
So, that's crazy. It's really
interesting.
And could you imagine being stuck there in the dark next to the train, but you can't get through the wall to get to the tunnel because you know that's the way out?
Yep. That's scary. So, sorry. Next is an encounter that someone experienced in the catacombs that I found on YouTube. So Kurt submitted this story to the Just Creepy YouTube channel. So I'm going to read it as him, or as what he had written. So, I always had a dream of going to Paris. Not to see the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, or any other typical tourist hotspot, but actually to see the Paris catacombs. I had been urban exploring in an abandoned building and cemeteries in my hometown in New Orleans since I was 10, and even traveled to a couple of other states just to document my findings. Normally, the scariest things I would see is a homeless person or a creepy statue in a graveyard. Nothing to feel that threatened by. But in 2014, when my older sister told me she'd be traveling to Europe for vacation over the summer, I begged to come along. I was 18 then and desperate to get away from the humdrum of everyday life and finally fulfill my childhood dream of going to the catacombs to explore. I've been planning it out for years. I would enter through the tunnel that I've seen YouTubers enter through online, bring a fishing reel with hundreds of yards fishing line and attach the end of the line to the entrance. I would let out slack, attach the reel from my backpack, and basically get lost. When I'm done, I would simply reel my way back. It had made perfect sense to my narrow-minded teenage self. I wanted to go to areas of the catacombs that people hadn't seen in hundreds of years. To go where no one else had been before was my dream as an urban explorer, and to me, there was nothing more exciting than going where you knew nobody else would be there. There would be no more ruining the moment by bumping into a fellow explorer. So after weeks of convincing, my college-age sister agreed to take me with her. It took a lot of talking to get her to agree to bring her little brother along, but with the help of my parents, she decided she would make the best of it. First, we went to Dublin, then London, which to me was pretty boring. then across the English Channel to our first trip in mainland Europe, Paris. I tried to get her to come with me, but she noped right out of it, insisting on seeing the beautiful city instead, and who could blame her? While she went to see the Eiffel Tower and all that other good stuff, I stayed in the hotel and waited for the evening when the weather cooled off a bit and made my way to the entrance by myself. First by cab, then by foot, as I made my way towards the crevice that led into the infamous Paris catacombs. I felt eager, almost energized. I stood at the entrance and looked into the pitch black and almost immediately crawled in. Once inside, I took the end of my fishing line and tied it to a big stone. No way I was getting lost. I turned on my dollar store LED flashlight. Cheap, right? I let out some reel and started my journey. At first, I snaked my way through what seemed like dozens of rooms covered with graffiti and evidence of teenage parties that famously took place there. After what seemed like an hour reading what was mostly likely French curse words all over the cave system and ghoulish figures sprayed painted on the ancient walls, there seemed to be what I was looking for. On the other side of a large room I was entering, I could see a bare wall with no sign of human disturbance. Great, I thought to myself, now the work really begins. As I drew closer, there was a shallow tunnel to my left that seemed to go on for only 20 yards before a dead end, rumbles strewn about. So I looked to my right and saw a narrow tunnel leading directly away from the dusty room. It was so small that I would have to crouch just to walk through it, and somehow, no matter how much I shined my flashlight down it, I couldn't see anything in the darkness, a total absence of light. It was the first time I doubted the journey. Up until then, it seemed like fun and games, but now the feeling of aloneness dawned on me. If I encountered trouble, there'd be no one to help. But I felt drawn to complete my lifelong journey, and with a gulp, I cautiously made my way in. Within 10 feet inside, I noticed the bottom of the medieval passage had begun to fill with water. At first, I thought my waterproof shoes would do the trick, but I soon found myself crouched over, drenched and dredging my way through the tunnel, with the water to my knees. The tunnel aimed gradually downwards, even further into the underworld beneath the city of Paris. Too late to turn back now, though. I kept going, and after a minute, there was a fork in the passage. One got smaller, narrowing to 4 feet tall, and the other got bigger, I'd say about 7. Not too hard to guess which one I took. I heard that the catacombs originally served as a mining system in the Middle Ages, but as I made my way further, the place seemed anything but an innocent miner's workplace. After about 100 feet further, the walls on either side widened into what seemed almost like a lobby and small rooms lined either side of me. I was beginning to feel very uneasy at this point. I had seemed so brave at the entrance to the teenage party's paradise just over an hour earlier, but now I cannot help but feel watched. I didn't want to know what was in these rooms, though I had a strong suspicion. My footsteps grew slower as they continued to kick up centuries-old dust. I knew I had to leave. I took the fishing reel I thought I brought with me into my hand and started to turn the crank, but there was no tension. After a couple of minutes of praying that the line would just pull tight once again, the end of the line slipped through my hand. I took the flashlight and examined it. It looked gnawed at, like a dog sharply chewed through it like a play toy. "I'm screwed," I said to myself in desperation. All of a sudden, I heard a splash from the way I entered. At first, I thought maybe a rock had fallen into the water. I waited and turned off my flashlight. Almost the second I turned off the flashlight, I heard what sounded like a sharp, clunky footsteps furiously running at me, and I bolted to my left towards a network of increasingly smaller rooms. Each room I entered, I staggered over jagged items all over the floor. I have no clue how I didn't trip, especially with my flashlight still off, but I traversed my way into room after room, the pile of objects becoming more difficult to manage each time before a mountain of these things prevented me from going any further. In the pitch black, I could hear heavy, unnatural breathing about 2 rooms away. I bit my tongue, and I begrudgingly took my flashlight out and hit the button. Before us stood a pile of human bones. Femurs, ribs, and all stuff you learned about in school just stacked in front of me like Jenga blocks. I looked to my right and there was a 3-foot-tall tunnel. I got on all fours and furiously crawled my way through the murky, foul-smelling water, flashlight clenching between my teeth. Finally, my stalker seemed to be gone. I couldn't hear anything anymore, but I know I couldn't go back the way I came. I was going to have to find another way out. With hundreds of miles of tunnels and passageways running below Paris, I knew this was a tall task, but I was not about to be caught by an unknown creature. Sometimes a tunnel would open up and I could walk. Other times it would narrow down again, and I will have to crawl laying on my belly just to make it through the other end. I was getting desperately lost. I was unable to remember which way I came, and the tunnels would often fork away and split, forcing me to make a gut instinct decision on which way to go. It was frigid now. My teeth clattered as I brought my soaking wet self slowly through the catacombs, now feeling as though these are my last minutes on Earth. My limbs felt as they were made of lead. It's hard to believe that once my dream had turned into a person's worst nightmare, lost underground in the world's biggest cemetery, as I dragged my beaten self through the maze for hours. My flashlight started to flicker. I would turn it off for a minute at a time to try to conserve the cheap small battery inside. Feeling my way through with my hands, I tried many times to see if I could get cell service, but of course there were none. The last time I checked, it said 4:17 a.m. I had started around 9 o'clock. I decided it was over. I plopped in the water, sitting crisscross. I turned off the flashlight and closed my eyes. In my mind, I'd said goodbye to everyone I knew, all my family members, friends, and even acquaintances. I decided to look at a picture of my family on my phone. I clicked it on and found the best picture of my parents, my sister, and I, and stared at it. My sister was smiling and my eyes welled up with tears. It made me feel worse that she would never know what happened, that her wonderful vacation would end up being a despairing disaster. My mind went quiet and my limbs went numb. How fitting for an urban explorer, right? I just leaned back against the wall behind me. I heard a familiar splash from about 50 feet away. I jumped up, grabbed my flashlight, and ran away like the Roadrunner from the cartoon. With no bones to trample on, I was running at what seemed like an Olympic runner's pace, and I felt hopeful as soon as those same clunky footsteps started to fade. I was starting to grin when, boom, I collided headfirst with a wall, dead end. Through my throbbing headache, I could hear the dreadful pitter-patter growing louder. Finally, it seemed to stop about 10 feet away, and that horrid breathing echoed in the passage around me. It stepped closer, and hands trembling, I decided to turn on the flashlight. If this was really the end, I was going to at least know what finished me off and take it like a man. It flicked on, and the sight before me nearly scared me to death before I could lay a finger on me. It was dark, gray, withered, ancient, void of emotion. What I saw before me was a disgustingly hunched yet still 6-foot-tall skeleton, jawbone heading down as if it was panting. Its empty sockets peered down at me, and though it had no eyes, I found myself in a staring contest with it. Soon it started convulsing, and I could hear a small whimper emitting from its bones. It grew louder like a chuckle, and finally all-out hysterical laughing. The shriek echoing throughout the lonely catacombs. Its bones shook and rattled with every painful laugh. It didn't seem to come from its mouth, rather it seemed to be vibrating from the skeleton itself. It sounded almost like a demonic joker until it grew silent. It bent down from its already stooped position, unnaturally long arms stretched towards me, and sprinted at me at full speed. I was still collapsed on the ground with my throbbing head, and I did the only thing I knew to do. I leapt up, waited until it was a foot in front of me, and grabbed at its bony arm with my left hand, flashlight dropping into the water. I immediately took my right fist and it slammed it with as much might as my tired body had, straight into the skull, screaming like a middle school girl. I closed my eyes and I heard a big crack. I was prepared to be attacked back in revenge, but silence followed. I slowly reopened them and picked my flashlight back up and pointed it around. Arriving at the ground below, the skeleton had lost all life, now just a pile of bones in front of me first and a puddle by my feet. Its skull had been bent severely from its neck, now almost perpendicular to the spine. Had I just killed a skeleton? What was it even doing alive to begin with? I stared it down at my hand, which was surprisingly unharmed. What? I thought to myself in amazement. How did I not have a nasty gash where the aching knuckles made contact with bare bones? I decided to power walk away from the scene in case that thing would still come back to the afterlife and approach me again. I cautiously waited until I was about 40 paces away and turned back around with the light. It was gone. There was nothing in the water, not a single rib anywhere. If anything, it scared me even worse. I kept walking back the way I came. All of a sudden, I felt my confidence return to me, like how it was when I entered the catacombs several hours earlier. I felt strangely good, like something was urging me, telling me that I could find my way back. Deciding to attempt a miracle and retrace my steps, I conserved my flashlight as well as I could, and after more hours of dragging myself through the tunnels, after a combination of walking, limping, and crawling, I started to recognize where I was. Before I knew it, I was slithering my way back through the muddy passage into the endless rooms of bones. I turned on my flashlight to see the same pile from earlier and even had the gall to laugh at it. That's nothing compared to what I saw earlier, I thought to myself. I made my way through the rooms, through the hall, and back to the pitch black tunnel into the large room. Now I looked at the far side and I felt like I won the lottery when I saw crudely spray-painted SpongeBob on the wall. Civilization, kind of. I knew my flashlight was about to go off, but in its last moment of life, I somehow found the end of the fishing line. Of all things, it had gotten snagged and broken on a wooden chair that some person had brought to the room. I turned the light off and felt my way back to the entrance, only using my hands and the fishing line through the pitch black. Not gonna lie, I tripped a couple times and walked into a couple walls, but I wasn't about to let that stop me now. Before I knew it, I could hear and smell fresh air. As I reached the end of the line, I looked up to see the tunnel entrance with the last of my strength. I lifted my cold, achy body through the crevice into the entrance above. As I made my way into the morning light, I winced, my eyes relishing the sound of the morning traffic and the bustle of the city. I slowly walked through the streets of Paris back to the hotel. I had lost my phone in the process of being pursued and I couldn't order a cab to pick me up, but I was just happy to be alive at this point. When I finally got back to the hotel room, I knocked on the door and my sister opened it. She had tears in her eyes and she looked as though she had been crying the whole night. She instantly threw her arms around me and kissed me on the neck, saying, "I thought I'd never see you again. I was so worried." So we ended up enjoying the rest of our European vacation, making sure not to lose sight of each other after that. I told her and everyone else for that matter that I had gotten lost, but I never mentioned the skeleton that attacked me. Sometimes I wonder if it was real. Maybe my mind was playing tricks on me in hysteria and tiredness. I don't know, and that's probably a good thing. My urban exploration days are over now, but this experience has always nagged at my conscience. I came here because of the memory, and the whole ordeal just haunts me. Sometimes I wake up at night screaming, having nightmares about being lost underground or being chased once again. Maybe by finally telling my story, I can finally put this whole thing to rest.
Wow.
The end. Sorry, I know that was kind of long, but I really liked it because it kind of showed how you can easily get lost in these tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And how he even said, it's like when he was like, it was like a big gallery and there were rooms to the sides. He's like, "I think I know what's in those rooms, but I don't want to look." It's like, this has centuries of bones. It has 6 million dead people. Like, how would you not think that there isn't some type of paranormal activity here?
Yeah, absolutely.
As for the skeleton, I don't know. I want to believe that I know, like, I believe what he saw, but I don't know.
Maybe he hallucinated.
That's what I was thinking, too. Like, when he slammed into that wall, like, and he said, "Oh, dead end," maybe it was, like, an actual person, and it was his mind trying to
make sense of what was happening.
Yeah, that, like, trying to make sense of what was going on at the time. So yeah, that was Le Catacombe de Paris.
That was good. Thank you for sharing that.
Thanks. I really recommend the movie As Above, So Below.
Even though you fell asleep through it?
If you're ever in Paris, go visit.
No, but seriously, that movie is really good. Watch it.
Yeah. Well, if you're in Paris, go visit the catacombs. I tried to get like a virtual tour because I went on their website and I was like, "Ooh, virtual tour." Dude, it was €8. I'm like, what the fuck? And I guess it's like a 40 minute to an hour long tour. So it's like everything, which is nice. But it's like, girl, if it's a virtual tour,
you're not even there and they're charging you.
I know. What the hell? And there's a conversion rate? Hell no.
It's a conversion rate
fee?
Right.
Yeah, almost. No, not even. It's like $12.
Oh, wow. I could buy two McDoubles, a small fry, and a drink with that.
You could buy two McDonald's meals. So yeah, that was my case. Thank you all for coming.
Wow, that was good. Thank you for that. So, now that we're done with your case, we're moving on to the palate cleanser. What type of goodies do you have for us today?
You sound like a game show person. Okay, so I don't know why I didn't look at my notes first, but yes, this was, we haven't talked about the Twice show, and we kind of already did, but I did want to, I wrote down Twice show, 10 out of 10. That show was so fucking good.
It was really good.
And even today, we went to eat ramen, and our server saw my phone case because I have a photo card of Dahyun. And she's like, I really like your phone case. I'm like, thanks.
Cute.
Stan Twice.
Yep.
I tried Air Maxes on for the first time.
Tell us about that experience.
Okay. So, I should have mentioned this for June for Pride Month, but... I'm just kidding. That's terrible. But the Air Maxes have like a slight little raise to the heel section.
Yeah, there's like a little air pocket in there to give you max air.
Girl, that's like a little kitten heel. Sounds a little fruity. Sounds fruity.
Don't tell the men that because then they'll stop wearing Air Maxes.
Well, you know how like...
You're going to put Nike out of business.
Don't care. Don't care. Wait, don't care plus ratio.
Am I
plus...
allowed to say that out loud? Are they going to sue us?
What is? Never mind. Moving on.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But the Air Maxes, I tried it on and I was like, girl, there's like a little kitten heel to this. Like, this thing's a little fruity.
You felt a little taller.
I kind of did. I mean, I kind of see why a lot of men like them now. Because I've always been like a Vans and Adidas type of girl. After that, I'm like, okay. Well, you know how like ancient, like Renaissance paintings always have those men with like the heels?
Yeah.
We're just going back to that.
You know what movie I think about all the time? The Three Musketeers with Logan Lerman that came out like very recently. It also had Mila Jovovich in it, where they had that man up there in fucking heels. And I'm like, he ate.
Work.
Honestly, he ate.
Work, diva. Yeah.
Those ugly ass heels.
But yeah, I didn't realize that men like the little kitten heels. That's why they like them. That's why they like those Air Maxes.
Also, they're comfortable.
They are, I will admit. But they were a little out of my price range at the moment. Sorry, I just wanted to talk shit about men. We watched the new Insidious movie.
We did. That was good.
Okay, was it though? Because I wrote on my notes that I wanted to talk about like American horror films, and
they always have good endings and you fucking hate that and you talk shit about it every time.
Yes. And when I That's when fair. You mean good endings, I'm it's like you're referring to like how everyone is happy at the end.
Yeah,
understandable. But I think a lot of American films are falling into the tropes of being very predictable. They're falling into the tropes of being predictable like that, where it's like at the end the evil is defeated and everyone goes home and everyone is happy,
but they leave a little door for a sequel in case they need to make more money.
That's true. Yeah, and that's what sucks about it. How, well, you've talked about it, you've actually brought it up to me and I never considered it before, where it's like some stories should have a good, like, should have an ending to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of series are written with the intention of saying, hey, we're only going to release two seasons and that's it.
That's how TV shows are being written now.
Yes, but they weren't before.
Previously, they would, like, retcon stuff because they fucked up. They didn't think the show was going to do as well. Mm-hmm. And then they're, like, 8 seasons in and they're like, fuck, well, we said that this character died, like, season 3 and now they're back, season 8. Or, I mean, that's a really good example of that is Supernatural. Like, how many fucking times is the world going to end?
Like, oh, brother, how many times are you going to kill Satan?
What the fuck?
Or point, Grey's Anatomy.
Yes.
Not that there's, like, an evil defeated, but it's like, girl, what is going on in that hospital?
Well, a doctor's job is never done.
I guess, but it doesn't mean you need to let the rest of us know.
Shonda Rhimes is gonna sue you.
She really is. She's actually gonna show up to my house and be like, ass. I heard what you said.
She said, how'd you like, how'd I get away with murder?
I was like, Shonda, it was so good. And she's like,
you only watched 2 seasons.
I was like, well, the only
that show was good. Okay, it was good, and then after a while I was like, I can't watch this anymore.
Oh, but that's a good example. That is such a good example of how it should have ended at a certain point, where it's like, you don't have to keep it going.
Yeah,
because if you keep it going, it kind of soils the series as a whole. Like, one bad season will make the entire show look bad.
It's
American Horror Story.
It's more like you can only get that so many times before you're like,
yes, you know, before it becomes, like, predictable.
Yeah, it's like,
it's like, oh brother, how many times?
Oh my god, they killed him.
Like, again.
Oh no, she's dead. Fucking he died dead. In the house fire.
Yeah.
Somebody's getting killed, and it's like,
But that's how a lot of American films... This is
so fucking boring. Shameless. Shameless was that show for me.
Yes.
How many fucking times can you fuck up your life through 20 seasons? I could not watch that show after the half of season one. That show made me irate.
I feel like I'm too irate. Far in. I'm way too far in. I'm on like season 8. You were like 8.
I was going to say, you were like, you've seen basically all the seasons, and every time... You haven't watched that show in years,
mm-hmm.
but the day that you pick that show back up, suddenly I have to go to the gym every time you're watching it.
And the thing is like, I don't even really pay attention to it because it's sometimes kind of predictable. The only times that they've ever changed things up is when the older sister Fiona like leaves. Like,
and then she's off the show now.
Yeah. Because I'm sure she was tired of it. It's like, how many fucking times am I going to do this?
How many times is Debbie going to annoy me and not take care of her kids?
Also, you have been paying attention.
I watched the TikTok clips, okay?
Okay.
I fucking hate that, too. Let's talk about that really quick.
What?
That TikTok will fucking show you, like, good-ass scenes from Grey's Anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
It's season 12, episode 36. So now you've got to watch 12 fucking seasons of a TV show just to understand the context of this one really good clip. Or the anime.
Another
or
example.
Or novella.
Another example of how shows should be ending for that reason. Why would you make someone go through like several seasons just to understand one reference? Like Friends. I'm sorry. I know people love Friends.
I do not like Friends.
But sorry, after Whitney. A while, it's like they should have ended a while back.
Yeah.
It's like, how more can you do? Like, what?
How more can how you
more,
do?
How more can you? I also don't speak English. I'm yeah. So
no,
sorry.
I don't either. It's fine.
But yeah, it's like a lot of shows should be written with the intention of saying, hey, we're going to do...
Throw in the towel. We're done.
2 seasons and that's it.
Yeah.
But like American movies are becoming really, really predictable where it's like the evil is defeated. Yay. Where it's like a lot of European films were like, foreign films actually in general, because it just seems to be like an American thing to do that. A lot of international films don't have that concept.
Everybody's dead.
Like The Medium. Was it a Thai film?
Everybody's dead.
Everybody dies.
Or
spoilers.
You were hallucinating the whole time and you killed everyone. That's yep. How it's like, oh my god, what? Or you were asleep this whole time. You were in a coma. It was a dream.
Yeah.
There's always
crazy... And that's a twist. That's different. I don't mind a twist. But it's like not everything has to be another cash grab, another possibility of a sequel.
Yeah.
Like, okay, Marvel Cinematic Universe, like, wrap it up. We're done.
That's why I feel like some people get so mad that horror movies are like too, quote-unquote, artsy.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically like Hereditary, Midsommar, like a lot of the Jordan Peele movies that are coming out. Like, they're like, those aren't actual horror movies. And I'm like, and you're fucking over here watching this gruel, this fucking happy ending type of horror movie shit. And I'm like, come on.
I prefer those types of movies, though. I prefer like Hereditary, Midsommar. The artsy ones? Yes.
You have to have an appreciation for them.
Yes.
Right?
It's I see like, that.
So, I don't know. It makes me, like, it's irritating to me when people are like, those aren't even horror movies. They're, like, they're just movies that people can talk about it and then think, like, feel smart. And it's like, not everything has to be a fucking slasher film, another fucking Saw movie. Not everything has to be like, come on.
Even slasher films are a whole other issue, like Americans' obsession with gore and things like that. Like, no.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, last topic, and we can move on because I feel like my case was kind of long.
Yeah.
Girl Dinner. Heard of it.
Girl Dinner.
Girl Dinner. I can't sing.
I cannot believe you hadn't heard of that until...
I haven't.
Until Mel mentioned it.
This was like 2 weeks ago. So I'm sure everyone at this point has seen the trend on TikTok.
Yeah.
But like a few weeks ago, we went out to eat with Mel and Anthony.
And Jessica.
And Jessica. And they brought it up. How it's like, oh yeah, we had girl dinner. I'm like,
You were shook. You were like, what?
I've never eaten with a girl before. Like, this is... I've never done this.
You've never seen a girl dinner before.
I've never seen a girl eat, actually. I've never met a girl.
I don't think they do eat.
That's what girl dinner is. Like that sleep? One, that one where it's like, this... is my girl dinner, and it was some girl like tucking herself into bed. I'm like, oh, that's good.
Some of the time I feel like you just like videos because you were like, I should have thought of that. Yeah, I guess I'll like it.
Like, it's good. Fuck.
Good. Yeah. Material.
Yep. People are so creative. Yeah. And I don't mean that sarcastically.
Girl dinner's a real thing, though.
No, I know it is. Mel brought it up, but she's like, yeah, Anthony was working out of town one time for a week.
And I lost 10 pounds.
And I lost 10 pounds. She just grabs a handful of almonds and a half-drunk Gatorade. No, that is girl dinner.
Her exact words were some olives, like a pickle, and maybe a piece of cheese, and that's what... And she said, that's what dinner was. Do not misquote her.
My apologies.
That is true.
That's how I would describe it to people. It's like, have you heard of a girl dinner?
The first time I had ever heard of girl dinner was Eliza Schlesinger when her specials came out on Netflix in like 2015, 2016. Mm-hmm. She mentions girl dinner in one of hers. She's like, you know, when you have like girl dinner where you grab like a handful of ham and some cheese, and you just can't go out after that. She mentioned
like a string cheese, I think is what she refers to.
Yes, yeah. And so that, like, I already knew the concept of girl dinner, so...
I'm literally a guy. I do not pay attention to
anything.
You really don't. And now they're trying to do boy dinner.
Boy dinner.
And that's kind of weird, because one of them I resonated very well with, of some guy that walks into his room, lifts up his blanket, and it's like a half-eaten pizza with a ranch cup. I'm like, okay, that's so mean. That's me-coded.
That's disgusting.
If you didn't live with me, my life would be completely different.
I know. I see it. I clean up. I just be
telling on myself.
I clean it, so I know.
Yeah. Anyway, do you want to jump into your story?
I was going to say, that's another can of worms we don't want to talk about on the show.
Men.
Huh? I was going to say more like your cleaning habits, but sure.
Oh, okay. Just men. Tomato, tomato. Men.
Boo.
Boo. Boo. Boo. Tomato, tomato. Okay. So let's jump into your card.
Okay. So for this month, I have, I don't know if you've heard of it. I know you have heard of it. I don't know why I'm acting brand new.
Never heard of it.
It's El Lobizon. We've heard of it. Destination Truth had a half episode about it way back when we used to be obsessed with Destination Truth. We keep mentioning that show on the show, but I feel like it influenced the show a lot.
It really did.
That Místico y Inexplicable with Jaime Musán too, that was one of my favorites.
Those two shows are the foundation of this podcast.
You know what, honestly, like, I was watching so much scary shit when I was a kid that and I should not have been watching it. Scariest Places on Earth, the 31 Days of Halloween on ABC Family.
Girl, that was me accidentally watching The Exorcist when I was like 8.
Same.
You know, shouldn't have been doing that.
I actually remember, like, so when I was a kid, like, our family used to live in one house, and it was like me, my parents, and my sibling in one room, my aunt and my uncle with their kids in another room. And so it was like a, you know, like a three bedroom house with like a pretty good square footage, but it was like different families living in one house.
Yeah.
So one time, on a channel, there was The Exorcist.
Oh my God.
My mom and dad let us watch The Exorcist with them, and they covered our eyes through the scary parts. But tell me, to a kid, that whole movie is not, like, tell me that that movie is not scary. Just the whole thing.
The entire movie is the scary part.
Yes.
And when, so, how, like, did they know when to cover your eyes?
They had watched it before, but it's like, oh, where she was peeing on the floor, where she was going down the stairs.
That was a deleted scene.
Which one?
Both of those.
Oh, really?
Those weren't always in the original cut.
So I knew that the part where she's like stabbing herself with the cross in the vagina was a deleted scene.
Because Why did you say it that way?
Because.
Stop. People are going to be like, yeah. Your podcast is haunted.
Yeah. So I literally did that voice on a cheeky sode when I was trying to act like La Siwanaba, when it's like,
kill them.
And yeah. Then everybody messaged us. Him. They're like, oh.
Like, I'll tell them to stop.
And it's like, no, that's me. I can do that voice. I'm talented. I'm a voice actor. I'm acting. This is acting.
This is acting.
Yes. So anyways, yeah. But the moral of the story is that I was watching way too many scary movies way too early in my life. But back to Destination Truth. They did a case on El Lobizón, and it's really interesting, so I'm going to tell you guys about it. My information came from fandom.com, wiki El Lobizón. There's an article called Tengo una maldición, soy un lobizón, el extraño paciente que llegó a una sala de urgencias, from eltucumano.com. It's an online news source. Okay. So the Lobizón, as the people of South America know it best, is also known and reported in Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil. This legend slightly differs from the traditional Western werewolf. Also, specifically, the Lobizón I'm talking about is from Argentina. According to many legends, the Lobizón is a type of werewolf, weredog, or even werefox, that is most often described as being quadrupedal, but is occasionally seen walking on its hind legs. How fucking scary is that? Sounds like a skinwalker to me, if you ask. Unlike the Hollywood version, a lobizón is created from the result of hereditary curse versus the bite of another wolf. Only the seventh son in an unbroken line of boys may inherit this condition. There are variations that exist in different regions. Some mention that it has to be an unbaptized child of an unbroken line of seven sons. Others mention that it has to be the seventh son of the seventh son, and so down the seventh to the seventh line. Unfortunately, in history, this has caused misguided judgment to children. As a result, this has caused a lot of people to give up these children for adoption, to outright abandon them, and some have even been killed by their own family in some cases.
Oh my God.
Like, that is how widespread and deep that belief is in some communities.
Well, I mean, if you have six kids...
Stop.
Stop. Yeah.
Condom.
Well...
Hello?
Wouldn't you think it's like, okay, this is my sixth son. There's always a 50-50% chance that it might be a girl, and it hasn't. Should I gamble and take it again? Like, no.
Control yourself. Control yourself.
Yeah.
Anyways, so like the Hollywood version of the werewolf, the Lobizón is subject to the cycles of the moon. Every night of the full moon at the stroke of midnight, especially if the full moon falls on a Friday night, the boy in question undergoes an agonizing transformation into a ferocious wolf-like beast of great size and strength that lives to hunt and kill. At dawn the next morning, the boy reverts to his human form to once again assume a normal life, or at least until the next full moon. Apart from being born the seventh son, it is said that if the Lobizón's saliva is sprinkled over another person, then they will gradually fall to the Lobizón's curse as well. Unlike the Hollywood version, the Lobizón is described as being a very large wolf or dog reported to be up to the size of a calf. It's typically described as having a muscular body covered in dense, dark-colored fur, padded feet that end in sharp claws, an elongated snout, large, dog-like ears, a furry tail, and a mouthful of razor-sharp teeth. The beast is said to be fairly short in stature and is sometimes seen as having legs like a child's. One eyewitness, a junkyard manager, compared the creature to an enormous monkey when he encountered the monster late one night. Additionally, according to eyewitness testimony, the Lobizón has a chilling, evil stare a lot like the infamous Beast of Bray Road from Wisconsin, in that its fearsome appearance kind of like freezes people when they see him. Like, it's like they look at their glowing eyes and they can't move anymore. And so, like, they're easier to, like, kidnap or hurt because of, like, just how, like,
how shocked
you are. Yeah, from, like, his stare. So, in addition to its fearsome appearance and gaze, the Lobizon is reported to be extremely savage. If cornered, which is not an easy task to do, the creature is said to be able to tear a bloody swathe through a half a dozen men very quickly. Some say that while the beast likes to feed on excrement, unbaptized babies, and the flesh of recently dead, it is still dangerous to people. If the creature should encounter a lone person, the Lobizon will not hesitate to attack. And when it does attack, there's only one thing to do. You have to run. El Lobizon is possessed of a natural strength and speed, and the beast's endurance ensures that any chase will be short-lived. After the monster wears its prey out, the Lobizon's ripping claws and teeth will tear at this person and do short work of their body. In short, it is no trouble for the beast to tear a grown man to pieces in minutes. So this is like something that has been quote unquote recorded. A Lobizon has been like a wild animal that's been described this way.
Wow.
Reports tell of Lobizons attacking domestic dogs and farm animals, but the beast has also been known to attack people as well, even to the extent of invading their homes. One particular report from Northern Argentina tells of a particularly bold Lobizon entering a private residence only to be clubbed and beaten by the occupants until the beast was seemingly dead. Once they had dragged the body outside, the creature picked itself up like it had never been harmed and ran off into the night.
What the fuck?
Yes. So, how to kill the beast? Like the Hollywood version of the monster, the Lobizon may be warded off with wolfsbane. While wolfsbane is not common in South America, the herb was imported by wise travelers who feared to be without the plant's protective powers. According to the tradition, the herb seeds were sown into soil of a freshly dug grave. This way, wolfsbane's apotropic properties would keep the grave's occupants at eternal peace. As for actually killing the beast, one does not need silver bullets or a consecrated weapon to get the job done. Like any other animal, the Lobizon may be dispatched with cold steel and guns, meaning firearms. Weapons like long swords and spears are recommended. Even if one has amassed a large group of men who are armed to the teeth, extreme caution is still advised. The Lobizon, as mentioned before, is extremely powerful and moves with a quickness that that does not match the size and stature of its body. Trying to pierce vital organs from a relatively safe distance is always the good bet. Even once the beast is down and seems to be dead, the creature's body should be decapitated with a sharp, heavy blade. Next, the body should be burned to ashes, and then the ashes should be scattered to the winds or dumped in a flowing river. These measures will prevent El Lobizon from regenerating and returning to life. That is a lot of steps to make sure that it is dead. While it's true that people still believe in the existence of werewolves all over the world, in Argentina the belief is so widespread that even the government is forced to acknowledge the existence of the beast. To this day, the government requires that all large families have their seven sons baptized to avoid any of the social stigma or superstition associated with the birth of a seventh son. In the 1920s, the president of Argentina, Dr. Juan Hipólito Yrigoyen, set forth an ingenious plan in order to get rid of his country of the superstition and evil that had made all seventh sons outcasts for decades. He eventually decreed that henceforth he would be the legal godfather of any seventh son born in Argentina. He also declared that a gold medal would be presented to the boy's parents during the baptism ceremony. As a token of his generosity, he proclaimed that all seventh sons, by law, would receive full educational scholarships until they reached the age of 21 years. As might be expected, the reports of infanticide and abandonment dropped dramatically at that time. Even now in the 21st century, those same laws are still in effect. The president himself still attends at least some of the baptism ceremonies, especially during election season. However, this has done little to quell the reports of ferocious dog-like creatures attacking livestock out in the country.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
It's nice to see that there was a noticeable change in the drop of children abandonment. Because it's like, why wouldn't it? I mean, understand it's like they're trying to help. It's like, hey, maybe it's their way of saying like, hey, to all the superstitious people, at least let's bring some type of reality to that.
Mm-hmm.
Good for them.
Right. Despite Yrigoyen's efforts and his generosity, El Lobizon has been seen by hundreds of eyewitnesses throughout the country. Not all of these sightings have been in rural areas, but the beast has also been seen in villages and small towns. These people swear that they have seen a werewolf-like beast. Usually these people are deeply religious, and so it is always assumed that those people are not likely to lie. And so whenever these people from these communities are talking about El Lobizon, it's almost like it's fact, because these are supposedly like deeply religious people that don't know how to lie. It has long been speculated that El Lobizon came to South America with Portuguese settlers. Historical records say that the Lobizon first made its appearance in the early 1900s, and reports indicate that the beast is still encountered in present day. More recently, some reports of the Lobizon have been linked with UFO activity.
What the?
Yes. While the fear that Argentinian people feel is very real, the beast doesn't seem to terrify them as much as some of the more gruesome monsters. This could be due to the fact that this particular werebeast prey mainly consists of farm animals, as the Lobizon takes delight in the taste of raw meat. There are very few, if any, reliable reports of this creature having killed and eaten anybody. Perhaps the beast views as humans being too risky to prey upon. But even though the dread of being devoured by the creature is low, the people are still very frightened by the notion of a Lobizon's curse coming down upon their families.
Do you remember my episode of the Chupacabra?
Oh, yes.
Supposedly believed that like UFOs or like some type of extraterrestrial dropped off a chupacabra as like an experiment to see how it reacted in a type of environment like the Earth.
Don't you feel like the description for el chupacabra and the Lobizon was kind of close?
Yeah. The difference is the method of killing.
Yes. Just a little weird. I also thought that when I like after I read that, I was like, very peculiar.
That is curious.
Okay, so next, this is an excerpt from an article that I found. Is it's called "Did I Cure a Werewolf?" And it's the article. It's the article from El Tucamano. One quiet night, with very little activity, while she was working on an emergency shift, a seriously injured man arrived to the hospital. He was immediately taken to the urgent care room, and Ana Maria attended to him immediately. That night, she was in charge of the emergency room, when upon entering the room, she found an elderly man with a deep wound on his arm. The man was covered in blood, but despite the impressive wound, he seemed to feel no pain. In any case, Dr. Ana Maria quickly approached him. While checking his wound, the man looked at her with strange eyes and said in a low voice, "I have a curse. I'm a werewolf." Ana Maria thought that the man was delirious, but she continued with her professional work. As the night progressed, the man's wound improved. That's when he began to tell Ana Maria his strange story. He told how years ago in the mountains, he was attacked by a beast. That thing bit him, then the curse fell on him, because in reality, what attacked him was a human being transformed into a kind of monster with a snout like dogs, referencing the Lobizon. According to his version, since then, as the moon grows, he begins to lose control of his being and transforms into a beast, unable to control his animal impulses. The doctor just listened to him. She didn't know how to react. Although the story sounded too strange to be true, she couldn't deny the strength and power which the man clung to, with which the man clung to her, to the story. Despite the fact that she wanted to think the man was sick, and that the wound made him delirious, she felt a strange sensation, something that she couldn't explain. Something was off. Finally, the next day, the man was released by another doctor, as he had supposedly improved significantly. Something that Dr. Ana Maria thought was very strange, because she had had a significant injury, was the loss of blood. She didn't understand the rapid recovery. Like, the wound was so like great in his arm, he should have lost a lot of blood and should not have recovered that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ana Maria never spoke to anyone about what had happened that night, nor the talk she had with the stranger, but she never forgot the strange experience that made her wonder about the world in which she lived in. The story of the werewolf may seem like a legend, but that night, Dr. Ana Maria had an experience that made her question her skepticism and her understanding of the world. And then eventually she gave her the story to a news site. recently. Yeah, I thought it was very interesting.
I mean, it was kind of weird how he just kind of confessed to it. It's like, hi, how are you doing? I'm the doctor. I'm a werewolf.
I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
I'm going to bite you.
It might have been that. I don't know. I thought it was very interesting. I feel like I subconsciously try to always like rationalize some of these things. But, I mean, it's possible. I don't know.
He recovered quickly, had a lot of blood loss, was not delirious. Like, he didn't suffer any, like, when you start losing blood, you start getting a little, you go into shock. Mm-hmm. You're not as responsive. Like, that, like, Doctora Ana Maria was like, that never happened, basically. Like, he was too strong for the wound that he had.
Wow.
So, it's very interesting. So the next one is called Vio al hombre lobo que atormentó a un pueblo por una inconfesable razón y asegura ese terror no se olvidó. So this is an article of which was given very recently, May 20th, 2023, actually, from kind of a report of what happened in a town for a long time. And so this is like, I'm going to read the article. Carlos Casares truly felt fear in March 1973. This marked the appearance of the Lobizon. When night fell, neighbors would take up arms, try and capture the creature they saw night after night jumping from roof to roof. So this was reported that many neighbors saw this animal jumping from roof to roof in their town. This is what investigator Fernando Soto Rolando revealed in an interview with TN Over the Legend. And so this website, or this new site, is TN.com. In March 1973, a werewolf walked through the Casarances streets in the neighborhood of Martin Fierro for 20 days. The creature's identikit showed its teeth and claws. From the cover of the newspaper, this terrified neighbors who still to this day, although 5 decades have passed, continue to talk about Carlos Casares el Lobizón. The historian and professor from Mar del Plata, Fernando Soto Roland, had his first contact with the legend when he was barely about 10 years old, and lived with his family in the neighborhooding town of Bolivar. From a distance, he understands the dimension of that event that marked his childhood and attributes to its origin of the vocation, to investigate the history, the belief, the system, the legends, and the urban myths. So he ended up being a reporter, an investigator or reporter, so this is what he does. Today, I remember it was almost with nostalgia for the lost fear, said Soto Roland in dialogue with Tien. However, he pointed out that although with the passage of time, you can see the story with certain irony or sarcasm, both adults and children at this time really felt terrified, and the terror was not forgotten, he stressed. So this is talking about the werewolf's identikit, little more. What they mean by identikit is the picture of the werewolf in the newspaper. So there was a picture, there's a headline picture in the newspaper where they described this werewolf. And it was a picture of it that showed its teeth, its claws, and its hair. Don't know where they got the picture from. I'm pretty sure that it was not a picture of the actual Lobizón.
Was it just what people described? Or like, was it like a...
I think it was a drawing.
Concept drawing.
Okay. I think it was a drawing. So, but that's what they're referring to when they keep saying identikit, which is, I think, a fault in translation. That's like what they call a picture in the newspaper, or like what somebody has drawn to describe the creature. The werewolf's identikit, little more than a black and white doodle, but enough to become anyone's nightmare, appeared on the front page of the newspaper El Oeste at the end of 1973. So it was a doodle. Carlos Casares, in the heart of the province of Buenos Aires and some 317 kilometers from the federal capital, was going through one of the worst floods in the history at the time. While Peronism returned to power after 18 years, it was a time marked by political violence, disenchantment, and Soto Roland added, many things came together to create a context in which the monsters of this monster could thrive in this town. The truth is that for 20 days, a werewolf kept the town on edge, and there was no shortage of those who began to come out at dusk armed to hunt it down. If he was in the newspaper, it had to be true. The historian recalled what he thought at the age of 10 when the father of a friend of his showed him the supposed photo of the werewolf on the cover of the newspaper. Like him, all the neighbors became convinced of its existence, and the rumor transcended the city limits of this time. Like him, all the neighbors became convinced of the existence, and the rumor transcended and traveled kind of throughout not only their town, but to the next towns over.
Mm-hmm. So it was spreading.
Yes. I still have that moment so vivid that it seems incredible to me that half a century has passed, says Soto Roland, and recalled, I suffered a kind of shock. In the towns of the interior character, like La Llorona or the Lobizon, have leave the written lines, the rumors become almost material. Over the years, and thanks to turning that childhood terror into his profession, Soto Roland investigated what was able to, what he was able to reconstruct, among others, the particular story, which he revealed in his book, El Lobizon de Carlos Casares. There were many witnesses who swore they had seen him make impressive leaps, jumps that allowed the creature to reach the roof of a house and get lost in the darkness, which at the time became even darker due to the times he was living in. However, despite the extraordinary abilities attributed to him, the conclusion he reached from the testimony surprised Soto Roland himself. The werewolf for his neighbors was none other than the photographer of the newspaper that had published the identikit of the supposed werewolf, Juan Carlos Testa, also known among his neighbors as Rafael, because before being a photojournalist, he was a member of a group that did covers of the famous Spanish singer. The name of Loco Testa appeared over and over again. The writer told this outlet and reaffirmed, for those people, he had been the werewolf and the responsible for that month of terror in Carlos Casares, with the sole intention of selling more newspapers. Probably there is some truth. He slipped on that hypothesis, but at the same time, he stressed that Testa was a nice man and much loved by the residents of the area. So, photographer is the one that's doing the Lobizon attacks. Interesting. In search of more information, one day Soto Roland came across one of Testa's daughters, Estefania, on the networks, who had shared a family photo with a caption that read, El Lobizon and his seven werewolves, which were his sons. The very clear reference pointed to the well-known Guarani myth of the seventh son who became a wolf like Nazareno Cruz. The young woman was the one who finally put the investigator in contact with a photographer from the newspaper To El Oeste. We had two or three talks, but the first thing I asked him was if it was him. Soto Roland recalled. Testa then dispatched with a detailed account of his supposed encounter with the creature, which the historian faithfully reproduces in this text. So basically he was like, no, it actually wasn't me. Here's what happened to me. I encountered this creature. Look. Werewolves don't exist, but there are. There are. The whole thing began with when a Giardini owned by former police sergeant Juan Barrencha appeared in the Martin Fierro neighborhood in an abandoned car. Pedrito Yemeli contacted me while I was at the newspaper. I went with the editor of the newspaper, Jeronimo Vasquez, and where I found Mendez, the butcher, with a knife in his hand, trembling with fear, explained the photographer. And he completed. Inside the car, there was a lot of blood, and Mendez recounted that a large silhouette ran out from inside the car, jumped over the clear wire fence, and ran over to the water from the floods in the direction of Juan Cerdas's farm. He howled, "That was the first appearance." In dialogue with TN, Soto Roland reviewed those interviews and stressed, "At no time did he admit to me that he was directly the werewolf. He was an extremely nice, ironic person." Testa spent his last years dedicating himself to beekeeping until he died in December of 2021. I was left wanting to have shared an afternoon with him, the writer admitted. The last time they talked, Testa said goodbye with a greeting that was less particular, brotherly greetings. And I didn't hug him because today my nails grew very long. Myth or reality? The same newspaper that fed the legend of the werewolf was the one that had begun to tone down the news when the hunt by self-summoned neighbors. To the end, the monster threatened to get out of control. Thus, after almost a month, the figure blurred. So basically, after they were publishing all of these reports, they're publishing that this werewolf is terrorizing the city, multiple like sightings of him. The newspaper themselves realized that they were like inciting kind of violence because these neighbors were going out, they were getting guns, they were trying to hunt this animal down. So they themselves kind of like decided to chill everybody down and say that like the attacks were going down, like that it wasn't being cited as much, which wasn't true.
Like the when I covered the Aswang, when the police were like, we're taking care of this, don't worry, because they didn't want panic.
Yes, but exactly, they didn't want panic.
The newspaper caused the panic.
Well if you think about it, like obviously there's political unrest during this time, there's floods. And so, like, it's raining all the time, and People are probably getting lost, losing their property, so there's a lot going on at this time. The werewolf was a milestone in the history of the town, emphasized Soto Roland, 50 years after all the collective madness, and noted, at this point, the legend of the 73 werewolf, or the 1973 werewolf, is an important part of Carlos Casares' intangible heritage. For the historian, the difficult moment that Casares was going through at the time had a direct relationship with the creation of the werewolf. There was enormous anguish in crisis situations like that. Monsters start to roam, as if people were looking to concretize the evils in character in order to be able to persecute them and give them some kind of solution, he said. There were no more strange creatures for Carlos Casares, however, Soto Roland ironized. I don't think the legend of the werewolf is something exclusive to those years. The world is going through a very difficult time, and I have no doubt that from now on, in the near or distant future, other visiting wolves will appear. So basically, he was saying that, like, maybe there was a wolf, maybe there wasn't a wolf. It just had to do with the unrest. But there are a lot of reports at this time of people actually experiencing them and being hurt by the werewolf or the Lobizon.
So,
and kind of the town trying to figure out who it was.
But it stopped, right?
Yes. Or is it still stopped going? After the 20 days.
Yeah.
So it was just 20 days of terror, and then it was done.
Oh my God. How have I never heard of this?
It was very interesting. Very interesting. And for a newspaper to publish this story from this writer is very interesting to me. So that was the story of El Lobizon. There's a lot of different versions. There's a lot of different abilities that they have, depending if you're looking at Paraguay, Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina. But I urge anybody that has time to actually go listen to some of these and maybe watch the special of Destination Truth, because that one was good as well.
Yep.
So, but that was it. Sure. That was my story of El Lobizon.
Wow.
I hope I did it justice. If anybody has any notes or if they have any corrections, please let us know.
Yep. If you may know more information, don't be scared to reach out.
Yeah, don't be scared.
Don't be scared.
Because I'm scared.
Well, I'm built different.
So. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Is that all we got? Yeah, that's all. Okay. We should be working on a new episode maybe soon. Maybe a new little
hopefully not episode. Late.
I really want to make the Chiquisodes like a more often, because I really like reacting to them.
I really like reading some like the stuff people send in, because some of them are genuinely creepy.
Yeah,
like we can read these cases all day in day out.
Yes,
but like personal experiences are always really strange to me. Yep. Really fucking weird, really creepy.
I was gonna say, like, for us, sometimes us covering these cases, they're so distant that sometimes they just seem like stories. But when it's coming from like you guys, like you're the listeners, like of Primos, Primas, and Primas, it's like, hey, this is my lived experience. It's like, oh shit, this is real. Like, that to me, that hits different.
Yeah, it's like, that could happen to me right now. If I go to sleep right now, this could happen to me.
Yep. So we like hearing what you all have to share. So, go ahead, do your outro. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, that's okay.
Part of it. So,
thank you for listening. Please follow us on Instagram at Guestbooky Podcast and on Twitter at Guestbooky Pod. Also, email us any story suggestions or your own scary stories at guestbookypodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Taylor Turner for the artwork and Kyle Fields for the intro music. And don't forget to tell someone you love how much they mean to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.